Did I ever tell you about the guy that I once knew? In fact, I met him several times, and we discussed the whole situation very, very, very
seriously and at great length and in great depth. There was this guy in Euclid, Ohio. You know, it's a funny thing how much you do in your life that is pure habit. I mean, you do stuff without actually thinking. Now, if you look up the word habit, aside from its theological meanings, you'll find that the word habit has some very interesting connotations. You know, it has to do with like doing things without ever thinking about them. You just do them because they're there to be done. It's like you're hung on a track somewhere, like a monorail. You know, you just keep doing this stuff. Well, I'd like to know just about how much of our lives, our average daily life, is concerned with this habit. You know, just habit. Now, I'm not talking about obvious habits like smoking cigars, chewing tobacco, spitting on the window. I'm talking about just habit, like speech habits. You know, you have to become conscious, I guess. The only time you really become conscious of your habits is when you're on the stage. And the next thing you know, somebody comes backstage and says, "Hey, why do you always scratch your knee like that?" I said, "Scratch my knee?" And I said, "Yes, it's a very interesting character thing that you had worked out there." And I said, "Don't you scratch your knee? You've been scratching your knee since you were 7. You don't know why. You just reach down. Every time you get nervous, you go, you cross your legs, and your great big fat old white socks are showing." Well, you know, I'll tell you, speaking of learning about the business of habit, there was this friend of mine who moved into one of these great big buildings on Park Avenue. You know, one of these new hippie whoopee buildings, like the Knee-High building or the Pepsi-Cola building or the Seagram's building. Almost all of them are named after whiskeys or something to drink. And he moved into one of these big buildings, and this company had been an old company, you know, for years, and everybody knew each other, and they're hitting each other in the back and yelling and hollering, a great old company, and they're, you know, they're all cheating on the expense account, and everything is working fine, and they're swinging with a secretary, and the whole bit is going on. You know, it's a real big, happy family. So one day, Mr. Bullard announces they're moving into the new building, the big move. And they've been planning this big move since 1911. And it had always been brought up before, the directors, you know, they're going to make the big move to the big building. We have moved. We've got to move forward with the times. We've got to get out there and march with the contemporary society, get out of this old rat hole. And the old rat hole, of course, was down in the 30s. Got to move up in the swinging 50s or the swishy 60s. They got to get way up there, see, where something's really swinging. So the guy, you know, they're all looking forward to this great moment where the big move is going to come. Well, finally, the big day arrived. And they moved into one of these buildings up there on Park Avenue, made out of almost completely solid glass, Reynolds wrap, and a few little aluminum nails, and a gigantic escalator that went up and down through the whole guts of the thing. And the building is totally transparent. In fact, he said, you know, it's a funny thing, when you got at a certain angle, you could see all the way over to Madison Avenue, just looking right through the building. He said, you could look right through it. You could see everything right on the way. And he said, if you got at another certain angle, the building was like a big prism. You could like look up at the clouds or something if you're walking past it, and you could focus lights and everything. But it's a totally, completely transparent building. So they moved in, and his company is like on about the second or third floor. And it is a total, they have a corner. The whole corner is theirs, the whole corner of this floor. And it's right on Park Avenue, right up there where all the traffic and the people are walking past. And the outfit moves in, and he gets in there, and everybody moves into his office. And he's got a window that goes right from the floor right to the ceiling. Right? That's just like that. It goes from the floor to the ceiling. And his little desky, and they have, of course, they brought all these new modern deskies in there, you know, little kind with a little formaldehyde. What is it? The formica top with the little aluminum things and little casters and stuff on the bottom and the kidney-shaped chairs and the whole jazz. You know, he moves in there, pink telephones and everything. And he gets into this place. Of course, everybody's all excited before they move. Oh, boy, get out of this rat hole. And of course, they once in a while in the old place, a rat did run across the stuff. A rat goes past. It's a rat hole. It's an old rat hole. Getting out. And they became used to referring to the old office as the rat hole. The rat hole. And the new place was called the new office or the new shop. They were always talking about, we're going to the new shop. We're going to the new shop, you know, of course, next week. Well, they finally did. You got the scene now. They've moved in. And over the weekend, you'd be surprised how, if any of you live out of town and don't know anything about this, but the moving processes of big offices is a gigantic operation. And it's almost always done at night. You know that? They move, and usually over the weekend. And so Friday night comes, and everybody's notified that he better lock up his desk. He better get all of his little private valuables out. And next Monday, to go to the new shop. Go to the new shop. That's where we'll be. New shop. And your office is number 2274, George. And all ready for the new... Oh, you got the scene? Well, he leaves Friday. He leaves the old rat hole. So... And next, he got all excited. He says he was very excited all weekend thinking about going to the new place, one of these new jazzy glass places with aluminum and green windshields looking out over the Park Avenue, the whole bit. Oh, boy. I mean, he was within spitting distance of the Seagram building, you know, with the fountains and the Lever House. And it's all there, the whole big complex of modern, swinging, hard-hitting, dynamic, socking, ever-expanding modern life. Well, he wanted to get there. He was very excited all week. Says he could hardly sleep all Saturday night, tossing and turning. Could hardly wait for the big day. And he goes all through Sunday. And he's breaking out in a sweat once in a while. He's thinking, and he's picking the suit he's going to wear and all that. Just like the first day in school, you know. So finally, it arrives. 8 o'clock in the morning. He rushes out of his pad, rushes into a cab, and he rushes down. And finally, he gets in front of this place, and there it is, resplendent in the sunlight. The sun is bouncing off the glass, and he looks up there. Ah, modern life! It's me. I'm here. I'm in last in New York. I'm here. What's happening? You know those pictures? He can just see Jack Lemmon going in and out and riding the escalator, meeting Shirley MacLaine, going up to her floor. You know the whole thing. Finally, they're out of the rat hole. Okay, you got it? Into modern life. Into modern existence. Well, he gets on the escalator, and he's feeling thin and hard. Taut. He's feeling like Gregory Peck, you know, with one of those little hats on. Gregory Peck moving into some wonderful plot where he's going to be very dynamic and he's going to be misunderstood and he's going to lead the organization out of the chaotic mess that was created by that old immoral head of the old chief. You know, that whole business. He's on there, his cheekbones are higher than they've ever been. And he's riding up the escalator, and he walks down the corridor, and it's one of these corridors, you know, with the big flat floors, formica, all the little walls. The johns are all locked, you know, everybody's has special little keys. Nobody can get into anything there unless you have the key. That's the whole thing about these new buildings. So everything is all locked. Broom closets they don't have, you know, they have anything. They must hose these buildings down once a month. So he finally arrives, and his place is one of these new... They've really done it. Have you been into these places where you look down at the end of the corridor, and there's just a big glass wall, glass doors, and you see a girl sitting in there, right in there. It's like showbiz. And she's looking down the corridor, and she's behind the glass. And behind her is usually either a blank, beautiful piece of hand-polished teak. It goes all the way up, and there's this sort of off peach-colored rug all the way over, stretches one floor. A few little books are back here on a shelf, and she's got three little pink phones, and she's a very pink girl sitting there, and she's got a pink dress, and she's got this very sharp, straight, clean limb, beautiful Vogue outlook. And she's looking out. They even have hired a new girl. It's like a new marquee on the theater. They got a new girl instead of a fat old frump that they used to have that hollered over the phone in the little rat hole. She's down in the mail room now, you know. She's got a little special desk down there. They put her down there where all she does is holler at the mail boys now once in a while. All right, everybody out! And so they got a girl now. Everything is clean. He looks down, and he doesn't even recognize his company. Aschenschlager Limited, you know, it's down there. And it's in modern stainless steel letters that are all carved and twisted, beautiful, like they're made, like Saarinen has done them, you know. And the letters are all there, and they're across this glass, this heavy glass doorway. It's just Aschenschlager Limited. Boy, and, you know, his stomach is feeling flat and hard. You know, it's a dynamic, hard-hitting. He could never recognize old Aschenschlager in that stainless steel. You know, Aschenschlager, the old guy with the sleeve guards who spit on the floor and yelled and hollered and hit people when they'd come in and give them bad messages and stuff. He just reached out and hit them. You know, they bring us to say, Watson is on the phone. Watson again! Pow! It hit him in the mouth. So everybody's afraid to come in to talk to old Ashi, see? But now in stainless steel, somehow it's very, very impersonal. You know, Aschenschlager Limited, very good, you know, dynamic publicity, public relations outfit. So he goes into his office. Now you got it, see? Got the scene? He goes in the office, And he walks in, and there's the girl out there. They have, you know, the new girl who's for three salesmen and all that. She's sitting there. She says, hello, how are you? How are you? Seymour? And Seymour waves, nods, oh, boy, the new officer. How's the new shop strike you? And everybody's sort of kind of happy, and they're all sitting there. It's all like new, you know, new toy. It's a kid's with a whole new toy. And they get into this. He gets into his office. Now, it's a little cubicle, see? You got the scene. It's glass all the way from top to bottom. He gets into his office, he sits down, and he's a little kidney-shaped thing that's sticking him in the back there where he sits. His old great big fat old rotten wooden chair has been thrown out. Now it's down at the Salvation Army. His old desk is at the Salvation Army, and he's really hard-hitting. Now he's got aluminum all over, and he's got Formica, and he's got teak, and he's got a couple of prints that were supplied by the company hanging up there. Everything, see, the whole bit. Except for one thing that he did not reckon with. One entire wall is made of this glass. You got the scene? All right, he sits down. It's now 20 minutes to 9, see, by the time he's ready there. He sits down in his Bond Italian silk suit. That's Bond clothes. It's a gas pipe rack type, and he sits down. Well, hey, George. Hey, George. Well, you see, the point is I have to make also that his desk was one of the kind of desks, you know, that it's kind of like a gigantic compost heap. Before this, it was a kind of desk, you know, that has one layer after layer after layer. and it was just a terrible kind of thing. You know, once in a while, the fire department would look in and make complaints. And he had the kind of desk that every couple of weeks, it would get impossible to find anything. You see, from that week, he would put boards or cardboard over that layer and start another layer. So it would look fresh for a while until finally he had all layers of stuff all the way up to his top. Well, now it's clean. It's absolutely clean. All that stuff has gone to the Salvation Army. All of his notes, his memos, his footballs, everything that he had on his desk, have gone to the Salvation Army. Now he's sitting in front of this vast expanse of liver-colored formica. He says, oh, hi, George. Well, let's go now. All ready for work. Ah, George, it's good to be. Clean slate, clean slate. He goes, bzz, bzz, bzz. He rings the buzzer for the girl. He says, say, would you bring me in the, bring me in the no-cal banana file, okay? All right, bring me in the no-cal banana file. I'm ready to go. Okay, baby. He sits back in his little aluminum chair, and he swivels around. He looks out, and there he sees outside, for the first time, he's looking out at the Vista. Now, that's in caps. It became later known as caps. It's the Vista, and he's looking right up Park Avenue, and right at his feet is this big intersection, you know, Park Avenue, and one of the 60s is coming together, and a million people are walking around, and he's looking down at them, so he's sitting right there framed, and they are looking up at him, which he did not reckon on. He always reckoned on looking out. He never thought they'd all look in. So everybody that walks past looks up, and he's sitting there, and all of a sudden, he's pulling up his socks, and he turns back to his desk. And the girl comes in and hands him the no-cal banana file. He opens up the no-cal banana file. He says, well, let's see. No-cal banana file. And some memo. Let's see the meeting last week. He looks up, and he is suddenly aware of 9 million eyes looking at his back. You know that terrible feeling you get when people are looking at you? That, you know it. There's a sixth sense. You know people are looking at you. And, you know, you get bugged. And he's saying, no-cal banana file. Say, Susie, will you please send me in the memos of the meeting we had the 24th over at the La Rochambeau, Chez Paris, will you? Please bring me the Yes. And he looks over his shoulder and looks out. And there it is again. 49 million people are walking back and forth on Park Avenue and making the turn. Look, and they're all looking up in those great big fat vacuous cream of wheat faces. They're all looking up at him. And you know, he wants to go up to this window and pull down the shades, but there's no shade or anything. He's got a great big fat piece of green glass with the sun coming in. And he walks and he looks down and they look up, you see. And a few of them even slow up and stop. Like they're waiting to see what he's going to do next. Well, he waves, hi, hi, and a couple of chicks, hi, hi, and one of them whispers something. He thinks they're talking about his suit, his tie. Look at that shirt on that nut. Oh, for crying out loud, what's happening to the neighborhood? Look at this guy, what an idiot. And he's up there, and he's beginning to get red in the neck, you know, terrible. So he sits down again at his desk, and he says, no, Cal, banana. No care banana. Hey, Susie, will you get J.D. on the phone for me? Yeah, right away. He's trying to pretend, of course, that nothing is happening and everything is okay, and he's still back in the rat hole. Nadia, no care banana, no care bananas, no care bananas, no care bananas for you. He turns around and he looks again. And this time, apparently a group of sightseers, a group of out-of-town tourister types from Cleveland, have been walking down the street, and they are pointing up. And the cheerleader, or whatever it is, that walks in front of all these tourists, you know, the guy with the little hat, is pointing up, and apparently he is saying, now, there up there, you see a genuine man in a gray flannel suit. Now, all of you people have heard about Madison Avenue people, ad agencies. You've heard about hard-hitting men. You've seen Gregory Peck play these roles many times in movies. You've seen Gregory Peck in the gray flannel suit, the man in the gray flannel suit. You've seen Gregory Peck in Gentleman's Agreement. And now, ladies and gentlemen, if you look carefully up there on the second floor, you will see outlined against... And all these people are standing there looking. A couple of them are going with the cameras, you know. And he's looking down, for crying out loud. And he, you know, and then it's just about this time, he goes, his phone. He picks up, hello? Oh, yeah, J.D. Yeah, well, look, I called. And it was that. At that moment, it really hits him. He sort of half turned to the left with his phone, and he realizes that no longer is he talking to J.D. on the phone. He is playing a scene. He has picked up the phone exactly the way Dana Andrews picks up his phone. And now he is very conscious of everything he is doing. He's saying, yes, yes, that's right, that's right. That's right. And he is aware that he no longer works in a place. He is now in showbiz. Literally, absolutely, thoroughly, and completely in showbiz. Now, I'm not making this up. He became extremely self-conscious in his office. And everybody's looking up at him. He's looking down at them. Now, most of us live our lives just being ourselves, you know? You just, you know, you walk around, you scratch, your nose runs, and you fool around. You play with your cap a little bit, you look in the window, you know, and you chew your gum. And you're just you. You know, you're like an animal out there in the woods. Well, when everybody starts to look and applaud and cheer, you cease being an animal in the woods. You become a moving symbol of something. And there he was. He is on the phone there, and he's, J.D., can I call you? I don't want to talk to you from here. I want to call you back, because he was really going to give this guy the business, you know? He says, can I call you? Yeah, there's a lot of other people here. Yeah, I can't talk. Yeah. Yeah, I'm in the office. Yeah, I'm in my office. Well, look, I'll call you back later, will you? Yeah, okay, later. Hangs up the pink phone and looks down, pulls up his socks. And real, you know, you don't pull your socks up on stage. I'll tell you this. It's one of the first things you learn is everything has to be definite. You cannot waste a movement on stage. And he realizes pulling up his socks immediately signals to everybody walking up and down Park Avenue, here's an indecisive schlunk. You know, you don't imagine Bernard Baruch sitting there pulling up his socks, crying out loud. What are you talking? Nelson Rockefeller never pulls up his socks. His socks are painted right on. Hey, looking down, you know, and he's pulling up his socks, and he's scratching. Finally, he gets up, and he goes into this girl's office who's in the next office, except that it's not really in the next office because half of her office has a big slash down the side of it with another big chunk of glass, and this time looking out on the 60s. You know, she doesn't get the Park Avenue view because she's the girl, you know, the girl. So he's standing there. He says, look, I want to talk to Mr. Oschenschlager about my office before this thing goes too far. And she says, okay, I'll make an appointment for you. When do you want to see him? He says, right away, as soon as possible. And so she gets Ashi on the phone, and 5 minutes later, he's in talking to Oschenschlager, and Oschenschlager has a piece of glass running from one end of his office to the other, bigger than Yankee Stadium. And he's on the corner yet. You know, he's got two big views. So how are you going to raise Cain with Oschenschlager? He walks in, and immediately the guys in the Seagram building are looking in at him. The guys from the Look building are looking down at him. He can see the Americana over there to the left. He looks to his right. The Pan Am building is looking down. And 4,000 beautiful models are looking up. You don't come in and say, Oschenschlager, I want my old closet back. I want to get back to the closet, the old rat hole. Well, to make a story which is somewhat sordid shorter, the entire character of this organization changed, and these guys have been working together for years. They're the kind of guys, you know, we're running inside in each other's office and hitting each other. Charlie, your brother, you old son of a gun, kicking each other and hollering. And, you know, the whole bit. Suddenly, practically overnight, it became a very formal place. A very, very formal place. And nobody went into anybody else's office without buzzing first on the pink phone. Yeah, and nobody put anything on the desks. He said he felt terrible when there was one piece of paper on his desk. You know, it's like it's spoiling the composition. He's got to throw the paper. So he had no papers, and he liked to hide behind his great big compost heap before he would hide. You know, he'd burrow in there, and he'd dig for apple cores and golf balls in it. Now, you know, it's just nothing but formica. All of a sudden, he'd sit there, and he said, all of a sudden, as though he was naked all the time. People were looking up, and he would walk in and out of the office. And then he got to choosing his suits very carefully. Before this, you know, he'd wear a T-shirt with his striped shorts underneath it, you know, with the tennis shoes and all that, you know. Now, oh, no, dark suits, white shirt, dark tie. He made sure that his socks had garters always pulled up, and he even got to the point where he was using a little makeup, you know, once in a while when the light was bad. He made sure that his hair was just right. He got the little thing with the toupee on the top and the whole. In short, he has become part of showbiz. He realized that. Old Aschenschlager took to shaving. Aschenschlager never hit people anymore, and it got so that he wanted Aschenschlager. So, you son of a gun, Watson, call Powell. Hit him in the mouth. Well, Aschenschlager would turn, and Aschenschlager, he began to realize, was playing Lewis Stone. Oh, well, let's sit down, Chet, and we'll talk this over man to man. Let's have a good heart-to-heart man-to-man talk. There's no sense in losing our tempers over this. In my long experience in the Aschenschlager organization, my long experience, it goes back to the very early days, the very earliest days of public relations, I feel in our consideration, he lasted just 4 months. And the whole organization slowly began to frazzle apart. And now, as far as I know, the only man who's sitting there overlooking Park Avenue is old Aschenschlager himself, playing Lewis Stone. And he's surrounded himself now with a large group of young, hard-hitting Time Life executives, all of whom graduated within the last year and a half from Yale and Ithaca State Teachers College. Yes, he's surrounded by a lot of young men who know how to ride an escalator. Young men who know how to make up and how to wear clothes. Young men who know how to button their collars down at the right angle. And who know how to talk into a telephone so that the cut of the jaw gives all that wonderful composition and hard-hitting, sharp, clean, decisive, dynamic, clean look. And all the group has slowly faded away, and they're all back in rat holes all over New York now. Little rotten rat holes everywhere. Oh, I was walking through the park one day. Hold it there. Well, speaking of rat holes, this is WORAM with FM New York, and we have with us Random House tonight, which, Random House, and that's that thing about the Jules Pfeiffer book, Hold Me. And if you haven't seen it, I would suggest you look at it. It's a story has been repeated countless times over. Do you know that I know one marriage that I know broke up, and I will tell you this. It's funny how few times playwrights or novelists take cognizance of that subtle thing, and I think it's a highly important thing, really, that environment plays on people's lives, attitudes, the way they are. It's hardly ever mentioned. It's rarely referred to that people can start killing each other because of the room they live in. We like to believe it's because one person is sensitive and beautiful and has a great sense of beauty and the other person is rotten that they start hitting each other. It could very well be the color of the wallpaper. In fact, most often is, as much as we'd like to pretend otherwise. And I can tell you, I know of one marriage that I can definitely tell you that the turning point in that marriage came the day that they gave up this place where they were living, this old rotten rat hole type brownstone. They gave it up and they moved into one of these big hard-hitting, swinging, dynamic, total living concept buildings over there in the 70s, you know, in 1st, 2nd Avenue, moved in one of those. That was the turning point. The minute they moved into this apartment, And I visited these people. I knew them before and after. I was there the second day after they moved in. It was peculiar. You know that strange sensation that people have? Do you know that feeling that you have when you're in a dentist's office? You're in the waiting room. And you're in a waiting room there, and you're surrounded by, even if you go up with somebody you know, an old friend of yours, you go up there with Charlie, you know, and you sit in the waiting room, and there on the wall on one side is a Grandma Moses print, and next to you is a pile of old National Geographics, and all those people are sitting around in that modern Danish furniture, and you can hear the screams and the bellowing of the wounded coming from the next room, and you sit there. Suddenly, your friend is not your friend anymore. He is just another floating bit of flotsam. A human, if you know, just a human cork, and you're both sitting there. And say, oh, yes, yeah, you're Charlie, aren't you? I've forgotten that Charlie. Yes, my name is Fred. I remember Fred. Yes, Charlie. Yes, we're here. Impacted wisdom tooth. Yes, yes, very painful. I'm glad you're here, Charlie. I'm glad you're here with me, Charlie. It's good to have a good friend with you while you're in your moment of travail, Charlie. Yes. It's the waiting room syndrome. Now, most modern apartments of this kind are merely waiting rooms. And the sad part of it, and the really sneaky part, is that nobody knows what they're waiting for. But they're waiting nevertheless. And you get into one of these totally impersonal places, no matter how many guys, you know, work on it, they put things. I guess it's the rat hole concept that we miss. We miss the fact that the frames in these windows do not crack. The idea of a cracking, rotten frame in a window that was a wooden frame, you know, and the paint is peeling off and it's sort of cracking in the dust and you can't get it out and you scrub it and there it is, it's a old rotten wooden thing. Somehow the building is growing old with you and you feel secure in it. But the minute you are living in a place that is permanent granite, you feel like 45 times more impermanent. Seriously, you do. And so I know this marriage very well, where these two people moved in, and I'm an old buddy type, you know. I used to go up to the apartment, knock down the door, and fall down and hit my head on the camel seat, you know, and yell and knock over the hi-fi and drink the beer and all the whole bit, you know, and throw your shoes under the side. You get in, the minute I got into this place, you know, I find myself 30 seconds later. It's a funny bit. I am feeling embarrassed because I do not have a tie on. And I am just me with these two people, you know. And he's sitting on the edge of a chair, and she says, don't you think our place is very beautiful, Gene? And I said, yes, it is very beautiful. And I look out, you know, the glass all over the place, and everything is aluminum. And then you could hear John's flushing for four blocks away. All the other police, you know, it's one of these buildings, you see. And you hear a guy next door, son of a God, I don't want. He's beating the daylights out of his wife. And on the next door, you hear somebody playing a record, and it's high fine. Up above, you hear people walking around. Well, this is not home, though, you see. It isn't the same kind of friendliness. What it is, really, is the sound coming out of the next room in the dentist office. It sounds no matter what sound you hear, it sounds like muffled suffering. Oh, yeah, you turn, you know, and you're eating the hamburger that was grilled on the new radar electronic type grill, and you say, well, it's funny, I heard something. It's funny. You hear mysterious sounds. It's a very, very funny. You hear the traffic all the way up here, don't you? Traffic, my foot. You can hear this chick's head bouncing off this polyethylene wall next to you. You know? Wow-wee. So, you know, so she is sitting there on the one end of their little breakfast nook set, and he is sitting on the other end of the little breakfast nook set, and I knew it was all over. All over. I knew it. Rotten music, please, at this point. All over. And sure enough, 3 months later, I'm walking down the street, and I meet old Chuck himself. And old Chuck says, say, Chef, do you know any pads down in the village that... the pads in the village? What do you want? You and Martha? He says, No. Did you hear? I said, didn't I hear? Wasn't I hear what? And I knew, of course. I knew, obviously. Well, you know, one of those things. Just one of those things. I said, what do you mean one of those things? It was that crummy lease. What do you mean one of those things? It was that rotten aluminum thing you were living in. That Reynolds wrap contraption you were in. He says, no. It was more than that. And all the while, I could hear the John splashing and people hitting each other. And I could see nothing but acres and acres and acres of polyethylene and all this plastic. And I could see great green pieces of glass and I could see aluminum. No, no, you don't have any understanding. It was more than that. Well, it turns out that, well, you don't want to hear about the kind of guy she met, do you? You do? You want to hear about that guy? That guy who was made out of aluminum and green glass? That guy who was made out of formica? He had a formica head? That guy you want to hear about? Oh, no, you don't want to hear. You don't want to hear the rest of that. And, of course, it will never go down in history as these two were undone by 4B. And you know what's the sad thing about it is that 4B is still lying over there as a giant people trap. And nobody knows it. They're racking out the $225 a month, little realizing that they are buying the big cheese. And that I would be willing to venture that before that building is torn down, blown up, or whatever happens to these aluminum buildings, before that building bites the dust, that apartment, 4B, and probably 74,000 like it, but 4B alone will probably kill at least, I'd say at least 35 human relationships before its evil work is done on this earth. Let me tell you one time about the rotten, sneaky car I bought. Do you want to hear about that? Oh, I'm going to tell you about the car I bought one time. I'm going with this chick. Everything's working fine. And, you know, I'm in school, in college. I'm working, and everything's going fine. I'm swinging. We're doing great. And I had this old car. I had, as a matter of fact, I had an MG, you know, the whole bit. Now, do you want to hear the whole story about that? And I went out, and I bought this club car. Oh, no, you don't want to hear about that. I wonder how many people have grown to hate each other, totally hate each other, as the result of 24 hours spent in the wrong car with that plastic dash staring at you and that blue steering wheel and that sound, impersonal, quiet, that car that doesn't care whether you live or die, doesn't give a damn. And you're driving along there, you know, and you sit to sort of a funny angle, and the seats are so wide that it just invites getting away. Just invites sneaking away, you know. And in fact, the car itself is so pristine and so antiseptic that you feel embarrassed if you don't sneak away. You know, really, it's like getting very, very friendly in a super modern waiting room at BBD&O. You just can't do it. I'm sorry. You just can't do it with all those marble eyeballs staring at you. You just can't. And I'm just curious how many families have been broken up by the new Super Six. Just at that moment, you know, something entered the lives of these people that had never been there before. When they drove out, say, isn't this a beautiful car? Aren't you glad we bought this, Madge? And Madge is saying, yes, it's just lovely. And she's running her hand over the hood and all that. You see, up to this point, the two of them had never even noticed the clunker they're in. They only noticed each other and dug it. Now they are being upstaged by this fantastic piece of metal and glass and chrome. And they spend all of their time living that rather than each other. Well, it's a very, you know, watch out for the seat covers, will you? Gee, for crying out loud, watch out. Get your feet off. Up to this time, she'd always sat, you know, with her feet pulled up, sitting on her shoes and all that. You don't do that when it's early Florentine plastic. I'm sorry, with gold needlepoint in it, with fleur-de-lis running up in the back and sideways, with rhinestones along the seat. You know, you just don't do that. I'm sorry. You know, I'm just posing a question here. How many people have been loused up by where they've been? You'll never know it. This is so subtle that you'll never know it. Tennessee Williams will never write a play about this because this is far more subtle to show. It is a very subtle thing. Believe me, It's much more subtle than all the obvious psychological aberrations which run through Alvey and run through all the various playwrights. No, this is a far more subtle and I think a far more dynamic thing in a way, because it's something that nobody can fight against. You can always fight against your own personality, and maybe it's a losing fight, but you can fight against it, you know. But you're really hard pressed to fight against that long gray-green hallway that every night when you come in, you have to face with those peculiar bluish lights and that stainless steel door on the automatic elevator that goes, whoonk. And you get inside and you're standing with the chick, and all the while you hear back of your playing is this little soft thing, you know. It's real soft. You hear playing back of you this music. Well, where do you want to go, Madge? Huh? What? Oh, really? Oh. The door opens and another rhinoceros gets on. Yeah. And all the while, all of your eyeballs are hopping up and down to the Muzak in the car. Oh, yeah. And then you get downstairs and they got this wind-up doorman. The key that comes out between his shoulder blades, in a little uniform. You go, and he hails a wind-up cab. And you get in the wind-up cab, and the wind-up cab driver drives you down to your office building, which has a giant key coming out of the top of it. Have you ever had the feeling that they ought to wind up the Pan Am building every morning? Or maybe somebody does at 2 o'clock in the morning, comes in with a big key. It's funny. It's also the Pan Am building. You have also the feeling about that building that it comes in slices. And one day, if a big wind comes, all the slices are going to fall off, like big sliced cheese or something. It's got a funny angle to it there. Have you ever seen this halva that's shaped like this? Yeah. It is. It's a kind of a hungry-making building, you know. Oh, yeah, so speaking of hungry, I mean, this is the time of the year, of course, when just can't help it. The yeast is flowing brisk and heavy, and the blood is pounding. I mean, it's May, and everything is, you know what I mean, see? Well, you find little angles all over. Every place you go, you look in the paper, you just see the leaves are out, and the little buds are beginning to unfold. People are starting to hit each other in fancy apartments all over New York, and they're beginning to wish they had the guts to cut out. Other guys are making, you know, it's a moment of decision. And today, from the Ann Landers column. Oh! Hi, George! Yes, men and women marching into the eternal springtime of the great union. Dear Ann Landers, my youngest brother is being married this fall to a girl who comes from a fine family. I have never met her or her people. They live several thousand miles away. Last week, I received a letter from the bride-to-be, and she has asked me to be her maid of honor. I would like to accept, but something is holding me back. During World War II, I ran around with a pretty fast crowd of girls. Well, one day, a bunch of us girls who worked in the PX went out one night and had our arms tattooed. I especially admired Skinny Wainwright at the time, General Skinny Wainwright, so his name is tattooed in red, white, and blue on my left arm. On my right arm is an eagle carrying a streamer which says, "Buy War Bonds." All these years, I've been wearing long-sleeved dresses because I am ashamed of the tattoos. A matron of honor has to wear the gown selected by the bride, and such gowns are usually sleeveless. Shall I tell her I can't accept and give no reason at all? Signed, a very patriotic, worried person. Oh, boy. Sometimes, you know, I'll tell you, it's very, very rare when you meet a girl that in some magical way fills every possible fantasy that you could ever have fantasized at 3 o'clock in the morning. And the idea of a girl with Skinny Wainwright tattooed on her left arm in red, white, and blue letters, and a gigantic flying eagle with the inscribed motto, "Buy War Bonds," tattooed on her right arm, fills something that I didn't believe actually existed. Well, my advice to you, baby, is roll up your sleeves. You will make the scene bigger than you ever thought you could make the scene. I'm serious. You will make the scene so big that even the people living down, way down deep, dark. Yes, give me the theme. That's it. Yes, bring it up. There you go. Deep, dark, in the heart of all of us, could not possibly but admit that here is a girl who at one time put it all on the line. That reminds me of a great joke. Shall I tell you the joke about this tattooed chick in North Africa? Carl, don't look at me like that. I'm just, it's a little jokey, and it's late, and all the kids are asleep, and it's a funny little joke I learned once. Well, I'll tell you the story. There was a sailor, see, and he's in Algiers. The time is World War II, and he comes in on, I believe it was a freighter. Actually, he was working with a merchant marine. Comes in the freighter, and he's walking along the main street in Algiers, and he meets this cop, and he says, "Say, cop, you know any chicks around here?" Well, the next thing you know, he's walking down the street with this girl who's tattooed. Now, that is the point of the story, you see. Oh, Carl, don't look at me like that. It's not the joke you think it is. Well, actually, I'll tell you, it's better than the joke that you think it is, because, well... nobody understands humor anymore. There's just no way to say. Just keep your knees loose, Dad, and watch what leases you sign.